In the mid-19th century, the world was ripe to be possessed by the powerful. Russia's steady subversion of Bulgar and Afghan alike, and her mysterious successes in the south, masked by distance and played over little-known lands, caused disquiet in London and blind worry in Calcutta. Later, the threat would come from France, Germany, Portugal, and even Italy, all passionate in their desire to expand into Africa. Behind every move was the threat of armed force against the most successful of colonial powers, Great Britain. Yet Britain desired to live in a parallel universe of progress, freedom, and peace. On the whole, this is the grand story of the second half of Victoria's reign. But it could only exist in a world it wanted to live in if it listened for, absorbed, and used to advantage intelligence about potential foes and their tricks, knavish or otherwise. Britain could never win at shadow boxing, and its magnificent navy was, when all was said and done, of little use away from the water's edge. In more subtle ways, however, Britain could combat that which she could detect, and the result was that for well over half a century, Britain was not involved in, nor suffered from, either a great European or a great Asian war. Britain played her cards well because she sat facing the mirror. But who sat facing the mirror? Britain's diplomatic machinery was almost powerless to collect the right information, analyze it enough to turn it into intelligence, or propose courses of action based on what it found in an increasingly complex world. To fill the vacuum, the governments of the day drew heavily on the experience and technical expertise of the little-known Intelligence Department, from 1888, the Intelligence Division, or ID, of the War Office. In short, the ID was useful to the politicians and great offices of state because it replaced conjecture with studied analysis. Initially, ministers and their officials came to rely on the division because it was convenient. If they did not agree, they could dismiss the ID's opinions with a polite "read and noted." After all, it was but a separate, innocuous subunit which printed maps and dealt with strange places and even stranger people. From the beginning, it was estranged from its notional overlords, the generals at Horse Guards, and on the surface carried no organisational clout. So, if they chose, the government could ignore the division and its advice. But just the opposite happened, and the young captains and majors with experience and expertise beyond their years wrote far-reaching memoranda, which affected policy and the lives of millions. As the century drew to a close, an increasing number of foreign, colonial and Indian office minutes ended with, "Presume you have asked the ID?" And back would come the answer, "Done." When the division did propose courses of action, it did so with evidence not usually available to others. This gave it a cachet and weight. It did its best to be unbiased, but by the 1890s, the intelligence division was so convinced that it knew what was best for the empire that when the government did not move as rapidly as the division believed it should have done, over the retention of the Sudan to Egypt and the capturing of the headwaters of the Nile, the division took matters into its own hands and dragged the empire behind it. This coincided with the Second South African, or Boer, War, which the ID had long predicted and planned for, warnings which the War Office ignored. This became public, and by the dawn of the Edwardian era, the value of intelligence was increasingly recognised, its insufficiency acknowledged. The great security organisations, both civil and military, which sprang into life then and subsequently, all owed their origin to the ID.